Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out. I'm Billy Allen.
I'm Niels Nielsen.
And I'm John Mayer. And today we are really excited to have a big time guest and really excited to learn from our guest. We have James Kerr, the author of Legacy, What the All Blacks Can Teach Us About the Business of Life. We chose Legacy as our book club book and we absolutely loved it. And we're just so honored to have him on the show. So thanks for joining us today, James.
That's a pleasure. Great to be here.
So to start, James, what was it about the All Blacks that drew you to them as the organization to study for this book?
Well, first, I'm a New Zealander, so I'm a Kiwi, you know, from Aotearoa, the land on the other side of the world, but I'm based in London. So it was an opportunity to kind of reconnect with, you know, my country and my team, I guess, kind of above all. And then what helps, of course, is they're such a phenomenally successful sports outfit and have been for such a long period of time. So, you know, their stats are incredible. You know, I think they're currently running at a 78% win rate over 100 years, or about 115 years. Over that century, they've only lost at home 37 times. You know, they've scored twice as many points for as against, been world champ now three times. Ireland's never beaten them. Scotland's never beaten them. Wales last beat them in 1953. You know, they're an incredible phenomenon and great case study in both an optimum, sustainable, high-performance culture and also a team that had to look at themselves from a cultural point of view and rebuild and reboot in 2004. And so, you know, I thought that just made a great case study in how to take a look at yourself, look at your identity, work your story, create belief and belonging within a team environment to contribute to getting the discretionary effort that's required to continually win and just keep on winning. So for me, it was a dream assignment, really, and an opportunity to go into a, you know, an extraordinary culture.
So you open the book up with your character chapter and, you know, the big takeaway was the sweep the sheds. And can you speak on why something as simple as sweep the sheds is so important to the All Blacks culture? And to kind of build on that and for me to play devil's advocate for a second, I'm wondering if, let's say, as a college coach, I realize my student athletes have limited time. So I'll have my equipment person clean the lockers, do the laundry. I'm wondering what your take is on a decision like that.
You know, in the end, it's about character and it's about self-sufficiency, actually, and about the idea. So for those of you who don't know the story, the All Blacks, after every test, after every practice, really take care of the rooms, the locker rooms, the sheds, sweep the sheds, make sure everything is kind of shipshape. Now, in a lot of ways, that's unremarkable. In a lot of ways, it is remarkable. You know, it's remarkable because in a time when there's not a lot of time around, when there are global superstars, you'd sort of think somebody could do that for them. You know, and there are more efficient ways of doing it. But you know, entitlement is kind of the enemy of high performance, I would say. You know, that if you think you've got it made, you're probably well on your way to losing your next encounter. Whenever you get ahead of yourself, things tend to go wrong. So the idea of humility as a core value, which is one of the All Blacks have three kind of cardinal values: humility, excellence, and respect. Respect beginning with self-respect and respect for your teammates and for the game and for the jersey you represent. Excellence to be the best team in the world and to win every game. And humility, which is that sort of don't get ahead of yourself. You know, no one's too big to do the small stuff that needs to get done. And that's very deliberate because it creates a culture of buy-in, of humility, of service, of contribution. And all of those things are really quite fundamental whenever you look at great elite outfits. So, you know, and it extends to, you know, I think what's interesting is that if you say take the British SAS, the Special Air Service, one of their core values is humility, humility and a sense of humor. If you look at the U.S. Navy SEALs, the trident that the SEALs get is the only insignia in the U.S. military, as I understand it, that the eagle has its head bowed in humility. Because as soon as you get ahead of yourself in special forces, you get killed. And so the idea of, you know, a beginner's mind and not getting ahead of yourself, earning the right, only being as good as your next game, not your last game, but your next game, and always having a point to prove, I think is really fundamental to the kind of mindset that's required in that kind of elite environment to really keep getting the job done. As soon as you get entitlement and sense of I'm special and all of that, you know, there's a sense of a loss of focus and a sense that victory will come easy. But, of course, victory never does. So I think it's quite fundamental to that idea of always having to go out and do the next thing and the next thing and win every game.
It's an unbelievably awesome concept to have that ingrained in the team like that. I'm just wondering about if you came across maybe a timeline of when that started for the All Blacks in particular, and then maybe what the discussion sounded like in order to implement that.
I think there's a couple of things. I think part of it is, you know, what's the timeline? I think part of the timeline has been, it's quite a Kiwi and quite a New Zealand and quite a Maori value set. You know, it's interesting that the Maori warriors on the carvings on the side of meeting houses, the indigenous people of New Zealand, the great warriors are carved as kind of grotesques almost. You know, they're not looking their best. Their tongues are coming out. They're really kind of not things of beauty. And the idea behind that is that to show yourself at your best for these warriors, these legends, would be vainglorious, would be arrogant, wouldn't have that kind of humility. So it goes bone deep, I think, in the country and the culture that the All Blacks represent. And there is something about that, not getting ahead of yourself, kind of thing more generally in the culture. I think specifically in the All Blacks, they possibly lost a little bit of that around 2004. The game had gone professional. It had exponentially, their profile had increased. And there are a lot of issues within the All Black camp. And the kind of new management at that point had resolved to do something about it. And they created a program, effectively a program. What they did, they locked themselves in a room for a number of days. This is Graham Henry, now Sir Graham Henry, Wayne Smith, Steve Hansen, Gilbert Anoka, who's the mental skills coach, a guy called Brian Lahore, an old kind of war horse and warrior around the All Blacks. And they started a conversation, and they brought a whole bunch of people in, from the captain and the vice captain to various former All Blacks and really the wider tribe, if you like, and began a conversation about what they needed to do. I think a lot of that was based around creating an environment that people wanted to be part of, you know, that was enjoyable. I think some of the joy had gone out for playing for this team. The pressure was huge and the visibility was huge. It became about creating a learning environment that of both professional and personal growth, if you like, sporting, athletic and personal growth, underpinned by these core values. And they encapsulated in a phrase that was, better people make better All Blacks. So, you know, defining a better All Black in a way is relatively easy. They're the guys who make good decisions under pressure on the paddock, score the points, the job. But the focus was really on the better people side of things. And how do you create leaders off the field so that they're better placed in moments of pressure to make good decisions? And that's really kind of evolving character and maturity and responsibility and accountability within the players. And they did it through creating a dual leadership model, which was really about passing the ball, handing responsibility over from the coaches to the players. So it became very player-led as much as possible. And there was a sense of, I mean, Wayne Smith, the assistant coach, has a great line where he says, people will rise to a challenge if it's their challenge. So by creating opportunities for people to take on responsibility and ownership of the project, if you like, the broader project, and not just being the guys who turn up to play, you get a lot more ownership. You've got a lot more implicit kind of leadership within your group. And that leads to commitment. It leads to peer-to-peer reinforcement of standards and expectations and values and so on, endorsing and enforcing the kind of behaviors that are required. And it leads to, you know, more engagement and over time higher performance. And a sense that, you know, there might be one captain, but there are 15 leaders on the field able to make good decisions on the pressure under paddock. And that comes down partly to character, or largely to character. And, you know, in a way, leadership is that idea of self-sufficiency. Where are you on that self-sufficiency scale between having a dependent mindset, waiting for other people to take care of it or to do it, or being a more independent mindset, which is taking ownership and accountability and responsibility and blame when it needs to be taken to be a leader? And so how do you take a group of people and push them along that spectrum from dependent to independent? Part of that is giving them responsibility and ownership. And so in a way, it neatly all ties in, kind of humility, this leadership. No one is bigger than the team. It's about your contribution. And it's about ultimately leaving the jersey in a better place, which I think is one of the core ideas within the camp. There's this tremendous legacy of 115 years at now 78% you know, win ratio. What do you bring to the team? What do you bring to the jersey? You know, what's your contribution going to be? What's your depth going to be in this story? And that's tremendously motivating for a bunch of young men sitting out to make their mark in the world of international sport. And it also, interestingly, I think, if I can kind of just ramble on and talk. So if no one knows anything about the All Blacks, they often know the haka, you know, the ceremonial challenge that's thrown down before every game. And in 2004, they were thinking of getting rid of the haka because it was quite a distracting phenomenon. It was sort of being seen to be for the cameras, for the brand, but it had become quite distant from the core identity of the team. And I think they did something very clever. They didn't throw out the old haka. It was discussed. What they decided to do was to create a new haka, to co-create a haka from within the team. And they brought in a wise man, a Maori wise man, Kapahanga exponent called Derek Lardelli, and he came in and worked with the team over quite a long period of time and asked them some quite fundamental questions about identity. Who are you? What does it mean to be a New Zealander? What does it mean to be an All Black? And what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be alive? What's life all about? And this was encapsulated into a new haka called Kapaupanga, which is sort of their special occasion haka. They throw it down on the big games. You know you're in for a big game when Kapaupanga comes out. And I think one of the things that's really interesting is that the chorus, if you like, it's not quite a chorus, but the chorus, if you like, says, this is our time, this is our moment. And it's your moment to do the business out there on the under pressure on the paddock. But it's also your kind of moment in this legacy, in this history. And it kind of refers back to a Maori spiritual concept, which goes by the name, great name, Whakapapa. I love saying that name in public. but this word it kind of means birth. It sort of is earth's time, from sort of sediment, you know, to sand, to stone, to crust, to, you know, rock, to the earth's crust. But on a human level, it's like a long unbroken chain of people, from the beginning of time to the end of eternity, and they're linked arm to arm. And the sun shines for a moment, but just for a moment on our time, on this time. And it reminds us that it's our opportunity and our obligation and our first responsibility to be a good ancestor, to represent all those who come before us and all those who come after, you know, to make our mark and to add to our legacy and to, as the All Blacks say, to leave the jersey in a better place. And that core purpose, that core driving belief, I think, is incredibly powerful and very archetypal and right kind of at the center of what it means to be an All Black, because every game's a big game. All Blacks don't lose. You go out there and every opportunity, every time you pull on that jersey, that jumper, you have an opportunity to make your mark and to write your story. And that's a tremendously powerful mindset and ethos. And you know, if you look at team dynamics, you know, I often think that there's the me and the we and the it. And there's the me, which is what's in it for me. Where's my glory going to come from? And then there's the we, which is, you know, okay, guys, let's go out there and do it together. But the doing it together is often, well, who's the we? Is it the offensive line or the defensive line? Is it the coaches or the players? And it can become very factionalized quite quickly within a team dynamic. But if you have an it, if you have a common cause, that thing that you're chasing together, then everything else kind of tends to fall into place a lot more, because you know what you're doing, why you're doing it, what you're playing for, what the narrative is and what the story is. And I think that's something that a lot of great teams have in place. You know, it's no surprise that, I don't know, a San Antonio Spurs has a storyteller at the helm, pound the rock, and, you know, how do I make my teammates better? You know, the sort of the narrative and the story about what it means and the why is incredibly powerful over a long period of time and gets more powerful. And it means that the people in the jersey, they're stewards of that jersey, they're stewards of that story, rather than being there for their own, you know, transfer market fee or whatever it is. And it's a very powerful story. There are a lot of other factors that make the All Blacks a very good sports outfit. But that sense of identity is incredibly strong, and it helps gel, I think, and glue their other assets together to deliver and keep on delivering, you know, exceptional high performance and really dominate internationally in a pretty difficult sport to dominate. So that's my kind of take on it.
It's easy to think about culture and talk about it in a kind of a macro setting, but I know for me and some of the listeners, it's really interesting to try to figure out what it looks like on a smaller scale. So when you talk about the start of this, when they sat down in a room and came up with the plan and had this, were there any missteps or problems that came out of that, or things that they did incorrect that the players and the coaches maybe didn't agree on that they had to work through? And if there was, could you give some examples?
Yeah. I mean, you know, my understanding of it, you know, there are a lot of missteps and a lot of things they did along the way that they then, I think, adjusted. And, you know, it's a continual learning process. Graham Henry has said to me, he said, you can't just go to the internet and look this stuff up. You know, you kind of need to do it and experience it and create a kind of a conversation around it and a feedback loop around it about what's working and what's not. In terms of stuff that didn't work, I think there's a number of stories. One, I think that the first thing they did in terms of the dual leadership model is they created a leadership group. And I think they created quite a large leadership group and it became a little bit unwieldy. I think it was sort of 9 or 10. And in the end, they brought it down to 6 or 7. And they found that that was for an extended squad of around 30 or thereabouts, that was about the right amount. There was an interesting unintended consequence of a kind of a resolution about standards around alcohol. And a lot of the players deliberately decided they weren't going to drink. But what happened within the fabric of the team is those bonding opportunities were minimized. And alcohol is a great social lubricant. So they started to lose cohesion as a group around this. And I think what they did very interestingly, this is another Wayne Smith initiative, they created a thing called the Rugby Club, which was on Tuesday night, they'd have the players, so on tour most of the time in camp, they'd have a social night and they'd have the players come along in their original club jerseys, jumpers, shirts, and they'd do kind of club things, play darts and have a quiet beer together and, you know, play a little bit of cards in the corner. They'd do that kind of original community-based, or, you know, where it all began for them. And that had a number of functions. One is to create opportunities for social cohesion. A second one was to remind them of the grassroots of who they represent, who they are and who they represent. But to do it in a way that sort of shifted the need for it to be all about alcohol. There was a pint there if you wanted one, but you didn't have to drink, sort of thing. And what that did was just create an alternative opportunity to achieve the same sort of cultural thing. I think Eddie Jones, the new England rugby coach, he's coached Australia and really has quite an amazing record. He said something about culture. He said, culture is just doing it right. You know, it's just doing it right. And it's really about behavior and about the behaviors that it takes. You know, if you go that really your performance is just the byproduct of your intrinsic talent or capability, that's kind of multiplied or subtracted by the behaviors you show, the way you prepare, the way you connect, the way you communicate, the kind of standards and expectations you have of each other. You know, you do that right, it'll bring out the best in yourself. And as Bill Walsh said for the San Francisco 49ers, the score will take care of itself. So on that micro level, I think it's about adjusting and just trying to find ways to do it right. And I know that's not overly analyzed in a way, but I think on a gut level, I think most people kind of get that. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that, you know, they definitely went down a lot of cul-de-sacs where they thought, you know, this isn't getting the kind of traction we want. And then thinking about how do we try it in a different way? You know, what is it we're trying to do here? And a lot of that is about, you know, getting cohesion, about getting, creating those opportunities for discretionary effort, getting the mindset in the right place. So there's a lot of talk about the environment and this idea of how do you create the right environment. Again, Wayne Smith, another quote, you know, exceptional performance requires an exceptional environment. So how do you create that environment where the right behaviors take place to bring out the best in everybody so they can go on and deliver when it matters?
Culture is a big buzzword and everybody kind of understands it. They all have a little bit different interpretations of what that looks like and where it actually lives when you're in the clubhouse, when you're on the field or the court. When somebody like you or an outsider walks into the All Blacks front office, the All Blacks locker room, or steps onto the field, what specific things are they going to see that might be different than any other place? Or are there any specific things that are going to be different? Or is it just the meaning behind those things that changes?
In terms of analyzing culture, you know, there are many different ways of looking at it, but a way of looking at it is, you know, if you talk to sociologists, anthropologists, culture's kind of manifested in a number of different ways. You know, it's manifested through symbol, through language, through story, through heroes, through rituals, rites, ceremonials, flags, all of that kind of thing, song, da da da. And but you could spice that down and say, actually, or cluster it and think it's really about, you know, verbalize, symbolize, and ritualize. What's the language that's used that's specific? What symbols of belief and belonging are involved in? What rituals, what repeated behaviors are involved? So if you're looking at sort of sociologically, that sort of tribal behavior, and in a way you can, the first thing, my impression going into a sort of an environment is, you know, I'll listen out for the language that I'm hearing. You know, it's no coincidence that the word outstanding crops up a lot within the All Black environment, but also the Navy SEALs. You know, it's outstanding because that's both a kind of an affirmation and an intention all in one go. And you could do a tape loop and bore yourself rigid with the amount of time you hear that kind of language or mantras. You know, once an All Black, always an All Black. You're an All Black 24/7. Stab me in the belly, not the back. Bleed for the team. You're a custodian of the jersey. You know, a singular language that's based on, as you say, based on that core identity story, I think. So you've got that, and then you've got a lot of symbols, you know, the badge, the jersey and the badge and all of those things. And then a lot of rituals. So the haka is obviously, you know, a core ritual, but there's also things like, you know, every team has them. The All Blacks went across the Severn Bridge to go to Wales, stand up halfway across and yell, "We never lose to Wales," you know, halfway across the bridge. So there's those sort of reminders along the way that kind of become things. And a lot of teams have those kind of rituals or ways of cementing their story and that idea of belief and belonging. I think there's also the, let's say in military terms, it's sort of called the offensive nature, a lack of fundamental conservatism in their planning for the future. When you're on top of your game, change your game. You know, trying something out, always trying to do it in a new way. And so I think that also factors in a lot of kind of cultural decisions. You know, how do we do this? What's the best setup to do this? And so on and so forth.
In your chapter on learning, you quote Graham Henry, he says, "We're always challenging the status quo, always challenging the way we do things, both as an individual, as a team. How can we do things better?" And I love this concept, but I imagine it's really hard to do when you're as successful as the All Blacks are and have been. Can you go into some of the details on how they've changed things up and how they challenge the status quo?
Yeah. On a macro level, the All Blacks were always very, very famous for grinding out stoic victories by one point. For most of their life, they've been about that. And as the game went professional, they particularly started to open up the game, make it a much more attractive game of rugby. So even on that level, the really big thing, they took that on in a way, took that on first. I think if we talk about it on a cultural level, messing with the haka was a big, big deal. Mm-hmm. You know, messing with a haka was a massive, massive deal. It had been around for 100 years. There's a huge amount of respect for it, and rightly. It taps into a cultural aspect of New Zealand that you don't mess with lightly. But having the kind of the, you know, I don't know what language I can use, the brains and the balls to go, this is a significant kind of center of gravity in terms of meaning and understanding, and then having the courage to reinvent it and to start again and kind of backing yourself, I think is indicative of that kind of attitude. I think playing sense, obviously every game, next Saturday is going to be a different game. So there's the opportunity to mix it up and to mess with it and do all of that. But I think it's that curiosity and that receptiveness to trying things out and to backing yourself that I think is one of the regenerative forces within that culture. A lot of teams will find a winning formula, and that winning formula will work for a period of time, but then suddenly it won't. And I think what the All Blacks do particularly well is once they played one game, they're moving on to the next thing, trying to evolve. And that's about doing Dave Brailsford and Team Sky. I'm not sure you're familiar with that as a case study, but British cycling went from sort of zero to hero quite radically in Olympic gold medals and so on. And one of the philosophies they used was what they called the aggregation of marginal gains. You know, don't try to do one thing 100% better. Try to do 100 things 1% better. The San Antonio Spurs might call it pounding the rock. You know, the marble's not going to split straight away, but you keep chipping away and chipping away and chipping away and doing it. And it, so there is a, I think, a mindset about being open to reinvention, but also a kind of constant pressure that's been put on constant improvement on small things every day. And that combination of that mindset and that activity, that energy, I think helps create a sustainably innovative environment, if that's not a contradiction in term.
Can those changes, when you're at the top, ever be premature?
Yeah, I think there's risk involved, absolutely. You know, I think you have to play smart. I imagine comes with experience. I think comes with experience or just good judgment. You know, you have to play smart. You don't want to sort of throw it all away. There was criticism in the early days of the Graham Henry reign that there was a policy they called rotation, which was about building depth in players, really. And so players weren't necessarily playing themselves into position and owning that spot. There was a constant kind of sense that actually we'll just we'll throw the horses in and give them a trot, and then we'll throw another lot in. And that really didn't play very well when it came to the pressure of the World Cup, I think, would be one of the contributing factors, I'd say, to the fact they came in slightly undercooked because there wasn't that sense of ownership, perhaps, that, that might have counted against them. So there's been a lot of failure on the way to great success. And I think they've won some big games. They've also lost some big games along the big way. And I think they would look at those as their great losses. There's been a couple of opportunities to equal or beat the streak, and they've fallen at the last hurdle in the last 4 years. They've fallen at that hurdle twice, which is an extraordinary achievement anyway, but they've lost those big games. So there'll be a constant look at looking from them about how do they get themselves in a position to be able to nail that last one and that one and do it every time.
Yeah, a team that has that kind of record and that much pressure, how do they handle losses?
Not very well.
How
are
the coaching staff ideally?
Yeah, well, I think it's partly is the coaching staff and also the captaincy at that point. So Sean Fitzpatrick, one of the great All Blacks, talked to me about kind of imbibing what it feels like to lose, creating that case for change, creating a moving away from state by locking the door and going, okay, guys, this is what it feels like. You know, this is not what we want to feel. Let's at least understand what losing feels like. Let's not make excuses and blame the ref and do all of that. Let's own this. You know, let's experience it. And lodge that one away as something a place we don't really want to go. So for him, harnessing that fear of failure, I guess, in a positive way is tremendously powerful. And understanding the power of a fear of failure and harnessing that, I think, is positive. You know, for any athlete, any performer in any field, really, it's just you don't want the anxiety of that to swamp you. You know, you want it to be a motive force, but not too much. So it's just getting that balance right. Gilbert Anoka, the mental skills coach, said, you know, test rugby is a battle between fear and faith, and may faith prevail. So there's a degree of, you know, not wanting to screw it up, wanting to get it right. That fear of failure is really important. But there's also that leap of faith into your in yourself and your own capability and capacity to do the job. And it's a fine line, I think, because if you get too much of faith and you forget about the fear, that's when you maybe overcorrect or take things for granted. So that mindset and getting that mindset right, you know, you want anxiety, you want a degree of, you know, if you want to do it, but you've still got to maintain a mindset that stays present, that doesn't become future-focused, that remains task-focused. I think the Navy SEALs have a great quote, you don't want to have to rise to the occasion. You want to fall back on training. You want to be really good to begin with and not have to seek superhero powers to kind of pull it out at the last minute. What you want to do is be ruthlessly good at what you do. And to do that, you need to maintain that optimum performance state, which is about executing that task. What the All Blacks call blue head, staying blue, you know, being in the moment, on task, accurate, precise, without that interference, in the moment, in the zone, in flow. Your horizon gets bigger, time slows down. How do you create that playing space for yourself on the field so that you're able to perform at your best?
So that was only part one of our conversation with James Kerr. He's got a lot of great things to say, and we're looking forward to picking up where we left off next week. Thanks for listening.
I had a couple of maybe just hypotheticals. The tests versus Wales tend to be maybe a little bit bigger than some of the other tests that they have because they've never lost. Am I correct in that?
They lost in 1953. They are very big tests. It's been 60 years or so, thereabouts.
Right. So the question I would have is, it sounds like that's a big part of the culture that they have, especially with those tests. What do you think would happen if they lost one of those tests now?
Oh, it's a painful thing to consider. I'm not sure even we go down this path. What do I think? I think they are stoic in the sense that one day they'll lose to Wales. One day they'll lose to Ireland. They will lose. I think it's what you do with that matters. It's how you get up after that matters. It's the next response. I think will always be, you're only as good as your next test. It's like, what do you do about it? I mean, they'll get slapped around in the papers. I think one thing that I thought was remarkable within the environment was the loyalty to their players shown by their coaching staff after a loss or after a poor show of form. One former All Black captain said, sometimes it feels like it's harder to get into the All Blacks than it does to get out of the All Blacks. Because once you're in and you've settled, you're kind of part of the team, the squad. It's about the team. And so they're building the foundations and you're part of the structure of it. So you have a bad game or a couple of bad games, you still aren't necessarily feeling that you're on the outer. There's obviously anxieties, normally, but there is a loyalty shown and probably a loyalty shown much more than the press who are looking for the next headline or the next scapegoat would show. So building that sort of sustainable environment where people feel safe to make decisions and to go for it and to back themselves is quite a remarkable piece, I thought, of that culture in terms of the way. So if you go out and you lose unexpectedly, you're not walking off the pitch thinking, that's my career gone. You might be, but it's unlikely to be. It's actually right, okay, guys, let's come down here and together and figure out how we're going to make this right. And I think compare that with some other sporting cultures. England, I'm probably going to get into trouble for saying it, but England rugby, I think, tends to kind of, the tail wags the dog often, and the press, which are very powerful here, often end up unduly perhaps influencing selection decisions. And stability and building a team is incredibly important, either on a coaching level or on a player level, athlete level. But often the knee-jerk reaction could be, well, we'll make wholesale changes rather than continue the investment that you have in your existing roster or whatever, becomes a much easier decision to make and to justify in the public space, but it may not be the right thing for the team. And I think one thing the All Blacks have done very well over time is they've created a protective environment for their players to go out there and express themselves and take risks and make the decisions and do all of that. And if you look at that as a leadership philosophy, it's not that dissimilar from what the military call mission command or commander's intent, which is, you have to get the right people on board. You need to train them. You need to make sure they know what the intention is. You need to set some parameters, and then you need to be able to trust. And it's really the trusting is the courage of leadership, is the courage to let go and let the players make the decisions and the team take ownership of it. And yet, you can trust and adjust, but there is a point of being able to step away. And I think that dual leadership model that we spoke about, where by the end of Graham Henry's tenure, there was no coaches team talk by the time the players went out, because really by that point, it's the team's time. It's not really about coaching, shouldn't make a difference at that point. Coaching should make a difference on Sunday and Monday and Tuesday and maybe Thursday, but by Friday, the team should be owning the performance and owning the team. So all of those things in combination, I think, create a very, very strong self-directed team able to deliver the performance and own the performance on the paddock.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I remember reading John Wooden would say, if he did his job, he could sit in the bleachers and they'd be able to perform. And that, I mean, that's what a good coach should be able to do. Easier said than done.
Much easier said than done. And you want to do both things. You want to pay attention to every single detail as a leader and, and be on top of all the details, but you need to know when to let go. There's a fantastic YouTube video. I don't know if you've seen, but it might be worth Googling. Of a polar bear cub falling into the water at a zoo. And the mother goes in to save this cub. But the mother doesn't help the cub out. she just comes in behind and kind of provides a safe space, if you like, and kind of gives the cub a bit of a nudge to help it out of its way, but lets the cub discover it for itself. And it's a fantastic metaphor, I think, for kind of leadership and coaching that, you know, in the end, the people you lead need to figure it out for themselves. They need to internalize the decision-making and the motor skills and whatever it is to do it. And exactly on the John Wooden comparison, it's like, actually, if you can ask all the right questions and basic on character and find that inner directed commitment to the team, you can watch it in the bleachers and should watch it in the bleachers, because not much you can do about it chatting on the sideline by that point. But it's all about the preparation. You know, the test begins on Sunday, not the next Saturday. It's all in the preparation. And then, you know, there's decisions to be made out there. And it depends on the sport, the amount of influence a coach can have clearly. But certainly in rugby, it's, you know, you're out there for most of the game and there's a couple of messages passed out through the water boy, but there's not a lot of control.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing for our sport, for volleyball. The impact we make is in practice when our matches start. We can't pass, set, or hit the ball. So you mentioned, again, in the book that the All Blacks set a goal to be the best rugby team there's ever been, which is an awesome expectation, and it's great because it's a reachable goal if you're a part of an organization like the All Blacks. But if you're taking over a new program, or for us, we play beach volleyball where we have a new partner almost every year, where you don't have that history, how do you go about setting expectations?
I think it's a great question. And I think the aspiration or the vision or the purpose or the language or the story is always going to be different. But some of the sort of structural elements or the principles kind of remain the same. You know, on one level, it's about just finding something, a common goal or a common vision or purpose that's relevant to whoever's that particular team. And that can be, hey, let's just not finish last. You know, if that's your ambition, that can be okay. You know, as long as it's shared and that's what it's about. You know, obviously, there's a great Maori quote that is, you know, reach for the highest cloud, because even if you come short, you'll hit a lofty mountain. So on one level, you may as well go for it. You may as well, you know, not may as well, but there is power in setting a stretch goal. But that stretch goal has to be a realistically achievable one. Otherwise, it's fantasy and it has no traction and no relevance. But I think Wayne Smith's career is worth looking at. In a way, he is the architect of a lot of the way the All Blacks rebooted. He was a player. He became the head coach. And then he kind of dropped back. I think he prefers to play not at the head coach role, but he's hugely influential in the kind of the guts, the heart and the soul of the team. And his career, if I can kind of top line it, is that he took over a professional franchise that, and it's about its second year, I think, of operation, that had very little identity. And it was sort of mid-table in the league, in the franchise series. And he realized that they weren't playing for anyone. People were going along to the curtain raisers. Fans were going along to the curtain raisers, having a drink and then leaving before the main game to show their disrespect for this new franchise that had crammed together a whole lot of different provinces that were traditionally enemies. So they needed to find a sense of meaning for the team. And they did it by looking at Shakespeare. So they were called the Crusaders. So about all they had was their name and a man on a horse with a sword. And so they went back to the Crusaders and they went back to Henry V and Shakespeare and the St. Crispin's Day speech, which is, "He who sheds his blood with me today will be my brother." Just that band of brothers kind of coda, if you like, mantra. And they built in quite quick time a story around that, about what it meant to be a Crusader. And they established values and principles and standards and expectations of each other. And they started to find ways to tell that story in film, but also through ritual and by kind of marking cards of each other's kind of reward and recognition and all of this. The next year, they won the franchise series, what was then the Super Series, and they won the next two in a row, and I think they've won 7 out of the next 10. It galvanized as a team. Then he goes on, and after a bit of a misstep, does the work with the All Blacks that I've talked about and have written about. And he took a sort of a sabbatical after the All Blacks won in 2011. And he went to the Chiefs as an assistant coach. And alongside Dave Rennie and a number of other people, they set up a kind of an identity culture program about what it meant to be a chief. And they went back to the Waikato Chiefs, the original Maori chiefs who conquered that territory. And they retraced their steps in their boot camp and their sort of preseason thing with sort of machetes cutting through bush together and doing it hard, but they bonded through adversity. And they created a narrative that was really strong and an identity that was very much them and their sense of common cause. They won that year and they won the next year, having been mid-table. So that sense of purpose delivers performance and delivers a sense of common cause that can create something. And it can come out of nothing. It doesn't need to be based on 115 years of winning. It can be based on a relatively short span of time, as long as it's common cause, as long as it's co-created and understood and bought into by that particular team at that particular time. So I don't know what their goal was at that, probably to just to win, you know, win every game. But there was a sense that there were strong values. People knew what they stood for and what they didn't. There was a clear vision and there was a driving purpose and a clear kind of sense of who we are and why we play for each other. Because, you know, in the military, they say people don't fight for king and country or the president or the flag. They fight for the bloke in the foxhole beside them. It's always about you and the people around you. And if you can create common cause and a common story and a sense of, yeah, let's do this together, you're setting your own pathway. But choose what that is, what you're going to achieve, what mark you're going to leave behind, how you're going to leave the jersey in a better place this particular time, this particular season, this particular playoffs. You know, figure out that story, commit to it, set standards and expectations around it of what you want from each other and what you commit to each other about it, and go out there and live it.
I like that because I feel like it's easy for us to make an excuse like, well, I don't have this background of 100 years of winning, so I don't have that identity I can draw upon. But like you're saying, we can create that, and maybe each year you start over, but at least you can have something to draw from or to be about as a team. Like anybody can do it, like you said.
After spending that amount of time with this culture in this organization, had you made any changes into kind of the way you do things in your own personal life?
Yeah, great question. I think absolutely. I think and that works on a number of different levels. I think if you're starting to look at your life as a legacy of leaving the jersey in a better place in your own life or in my own life, I think it makes some of the small decisions easier because you're looking for value and contribution and looking at the big picture all the time rather than tomorrow's hassle, you know, or whatever. So I think on that level it helps. I think one of the most inspiring, perhaps the most inspiring player within the All Blacks setup was a guy called Brad Thorn, who was 36 when he won a World Cup. So an incredible athlete, kind of in the engine room of the team. He then went off. He was a double international anyway. He had played rugby league for Australia. Then he became an All Black, won a World Cup at 36, goes on at 37 to win a European Cup. He's just retired age 40, but apparently is only able to retire to become a kind of coach, player coach. So he'll be 41 and playing at the top level of professional sport. So an amazing athlete, but he describes himself as a lazy kid. And he said his father, who died when Brad was a teenager, left him a legacy, left him a motto. And that motto was, "Champions do extra." So Brad's sort of first into the gym and the last to leave. If he's asked to run a mile, he'll run a mile and a half. He always looks for those opportunities to just do that little bit extra, to just push it. And it's really an encapsulation of that marginal gains philosophy, but on a personal level, I think. How do you just push it and do that 100 things, just that 1% better? And so that champions do extra for me has become a little bit of a mantra when I look at any project I'm thinking about. It's how do I just push it, just do that little bit of extra? How do I create that little extra advantage? How do I condition myself a little bit more? What can I bring to this game? So on that level, I think, two answers to your question, but on the bigger picture with if you've got one life, what are you going to do in it? What's your legacy going to be kind of level, a bit more purpose level. And then on a little bit more kind of tactical or transactional, you know, how can I just create an extra margin here a little bit? You know, in football, you know, it's a game of inches. How do I pound the rock? How do I do that extra? How do I get those inches? So both personal and a legacy, I think it's been massively important.
Awesome, James. We have listener questions now. Anthony from our message board asks, has there been anything since writing the book that you would wish you would have been able to add?
Well, I'm about to do a kind of a post second World Cup version. But in terms of the book, they've now gone on from having two World Cups to three. So I'd like to be able to get that in the book, just to remind everybody. I think some conversations I've had with various people since have various phrases have come up. And I think one of them was with Graham Henry, where he talked about the way they work together as a coaching unit. So there were sort of three quite big star coaches all working as a unit. And so ego, obviously, you know, the potentially issues to arise and how do you create consensus and how do you do all of that? And they had a phrase they used, which was disagree then commit. The idea really that the first phase of any kind of project, if you like, is everybody disagree. And, you know, the SAS talk about, you know, you want to have rank but no class. Sure, there are decision makers, but everybody is equal within that environment and respected on that level. And that debate and that discussion is honest, candid, and true. So stab me in the belly, not the back. Tell me what I need to know to get better. Let's look at our everything in the round and be really honest and straight about it and make sure everybody's point of view is heard, what the SAS call a Chinese parliament. But when that parliament has finished and a decision and the senior person that will make that decision, once that decision has been reached, then the role of the team is to commit. The time for discussion and debate and disagreement has ended, and there is a second phase, if you like, which is about commitment. Okay, guys, decisions have been made. Let's get the job done. Being very, very clear that there is two kind of phases, if you like, in cooperation and collaboration, that you don't get a vote once a decision has been made, and that being fine. Kind of that follow the spearhead idea, the Maori proverb, you know, a spearhead has three points. And everybody within it, if it's a symbol for a team, is welcome to follow whichever point, whichever tip they want. But the weapon itself will only have force if everybody moves in the same direction. So disagree, but then commit to that spearhead, to that sense of direction. And as the All Blacks say, no dickheads. You know, once you're on board, let's get this job done.
I love that. That encapsulates so much in that one saying.
I'm going to go to another question. This one is from Ricky. He starts out by saying, in quotes, better people make better All Blacks. And he wants to know if you think better people are born or made. And that is the quality inherent or can it be trained?
I think it can be trained. I mean, I think there are possibly some people who are untrainable, maybe. But I think character really is maturity a lot of the time. Taking on ownership and taking accountability and becoming more responsible. Anyone who's become a parent knows how quickly you can grow up and take on a more value-based life because you realize you're representing a young, impressionable life. I think everybody has the capability of evolving their character. Perhaps some are born intuitively with a stronger or more defined-based character, but I certainly don't believe, you know, there are hopeless cases. I think often it becomes also about perspective. It's character towards what and where is your allegiance and so on. And that becomes about common cause and fighting for the bloke in the foxhole beside you and doing right by your mates. So creating that cohesion and that sense of belief and belonging is really important because you also need that character making a contribution to something they believe in. So I'm not sure that answers your question, but absolutely, I think it can be evolved and developed.
So Geraldine asks, how is responsibility for culture, motivation, et cetera, divided between the coach, captains, and players? What's the role for each person?
I think one of the ex-All Blacks is a man called Gilbert Anoka, who is the mental skills coach. And really, he's sort of a psychologist and facilitator and cultural custodian and a really very important people within that cultural setup. So I would say, in a way, if it's purely about motivation, he would be the motivator, if you like. But clearly the strongest motivator is an internal one within players in terms of, you know, what this means and why we're playing and so on. So I think if you answered that fairly, the responsibility for it lies with everybody. You know, one captain, but 15 players and so on. And anyone playing outside that can be an incredibly demoralizing force. But absolutely, it's the Gilbert Anoka factor. And I think it's surprising to me that more elite teams, there are not more Gilbert Anokas around. Gilbert's been with the All Blacks for 15 years. He doesn't have a selectorial role as a coach, but he has a facilitative one. And I think that makes him a very safe space for the players, a very effective feedback loop to the coaches, but it really allows him to get under the skin of what the players require at any one time to be in the optimum state for when they play. So, you know, if the buck stops with anyone on that question, I think it is with a Gilbert and Noka. But I think the reality is the buck should be spread by everybody. That if you have that common cause and that sense of commitment and community, really everybody should be within that environment looking for how they can make their teammate better, as the Spurs would say. Greg Popovich would say, how do I make my teammates better? So, you know, Gilbert and Noka and everybody. One captain, 15 leaders.
Listener Andrew Fuller asks, what way can we be great ancestors and plant trees we'll never see? And most of our listeners are either coaches or players.
Yeah, great question. One of the great insights I got was when a player becomes a player within the All Blacks, a rookie becomes a player, they're asked to stand up in front of the rest of the players and answer these questions. One is, what can you bring to this team? And the second question is, what are you prepared to sacrifice? So what can you bring to this team? It's a big question with the All Blacks. You know, what can you bring to this environment that has had so much success over such a long period of time? What's going to be your contribution? And what are you prepared to sacrifice? What are you prepared to give up? Is that comfort, physical, an easy life? Is it about looking good? You know, all of those kind of things. Is it about being shy? You know, whatever the stuff that holds you back is. And I just think in answer to that much bigger question about, you know, planting trees that you'll never sit in the shade of, great old Greek quote, is what can you bring? What can you bring to this life, to this legacy, to this lineage? What can you build on from future generations for the next generation? What is your common cause going to be? And what are you prepared to do to achieve that? What are you prepared to sacrifice for that? And I think they're great questions beyond sport, actually. I think they're great questions in terms of, you know, who are we and what is our role here? We have a short flickering moment in the jersey of life, if you like, you know, in the black jersey of life with the silver fern. You know, what can we bring to this team, to the human team, if you like? And what are we prepared to sacrifice in our own lives? Because certainly you need to sacrifice time and other lives and other opportunities, other things you might do, a day at the beach or a burger after a game, or all of those things that you have to give up to really achieve those commitments that you want to do. So, you know, what can you do about it? I think they're two great questions to go, well, what can you bring and what are you prepared to do? And then make as big a difference as you can, whether in your team or within the world. Just one other thing at the risk of going on. I love the story about the South African cricket team, the Proteas. After apartheid, they had sort of lost their way a little bit, and they put together a cultural reboot program, and it was based around a word, a sort of central organizing idea. Their version of Better People Make Better All Blacks was the word Ubuntu. And Ubuntu is an old African word, tribal word. It's difficult to translate, but it kind of means you're the pebble in the pond and the ripples go outwards. And everybody that you touch, communicate with, come across in your life, you will make an impact on, either positively or negatively. And it's up to you to define the kind of impact that you're going to make. And what I think is really interesting with the Proteas is that they went from mid-table in international cricket to, within a couple of years, top of tests, top of one day, and top of the short form, T20. So that this higher purpose delivered higher performance, if you like. It galvanized that team around a sense of playing for something bigger than themselves. And if you listen to Daniel Pink or read his book Drive, which is a very interesting book about motivation, just to refer to that question before, he says that, you know, motivated environments are about purpose, mastery, and autonomy. They're about purpose, playing for something bigger than yourself, for something that makes a difference. It's about mastery, being in an environment that you're absolutely able to get better at that thing that you want to get better at. And autonomy, you want to be able to do it on your own terms, aligned with your own values, in your own way, take ownership and responsibility for it. So that kind of holy trinity of purpose, mastery, and autonomy, I think is a fantastic way of looking at it. And the purpose side of it, if you're thinking about planting trees you'll never sit in the shade of, is, you know, we've got a limited time in this world or in this team. What am I going to bring and what am I prepared to sacrifice?
That's awesome. This one's from my wife, so I have to ask it. No, just kidding. Yeah. It's a good question too. And we had another person write in and kind of asked the same question, saying how in the book you talk about, and you talked about it earlier in the interview, how the All Blacks were able to embrace expectations and use fear of failure to motivate them. And Daniel Kahneman's loss aversion principle, which further supports this. But then there's, and we've talked about it on this podcast a lot, how there's the opposing thought of fear of failure is detrimental. It puts one into a threat state, and the body's physiological response can hamper performance versus the challenge state, which allows one to perform more freely. So just kind of wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think it comes down to sort of excitement versus anxiety almost, if we think about it in terms of a state. That, you know, fear of failure is fantastically important, but you can't create an optimum performance state in a state of fear. So between fear and faith, how do you create the right amount of anxiety and being keyed up, but also how do you create a mental state where you're able to be quiet in a changing, threatening world? And it's a little bit like driving a manual car. It's getting the right balance between the throttle, the accelerator, and the clutch. You put a bit too much on one, then you'll flood the engine. If you put a little bit less, you'll stall for another reason. So it's in that nexus, I think, is exactly right. But I think there's another way of looking at it, which is how do you create the triggers to bring yourself into an optimum performance state? And what is an optimum performance state? What is your personal optimum performance state? And that tends to be a state in which, you know, sports people, if you look at a Ronaldo or somebody playing very, very high level football over here, they're thinking a lot less than somebody playing street football or village common football. They're having to think about what they're doing a lot more. The thinking state isn't necessarily the doing state. But to be in a mindful, situationally aware state, the All Blacks call it blue head, where you're in the moment, in the zone, on task, just executing. You're not living in any future or past expectation. All of that is required, not to have to rise to the occasion, but to fall back on your training, to perform to the best of your ability. In preparation for that, expectation, fear of failure, all of that stuff is really important. You know, it gets you out of bed early in the morning and it means you do that little bit extra and you do all of that. But on the pitch, under pressure, that's not the kind of where you want to be. It's the fear of failure is not useful at that point. You've got that anyway. It's really about how do you maintain that optimal performance state? How do you stay blue? Mm. How do you keep it calm, stay accurate, on task, situationally aware? Because being in that state allows you to respond and adapt and overcome any situation that is thrown at you.
Thank you for writing this book. I can tell you right now, for anybody who hasn't read it, that's listening, just for where I'm at, I just took over a high school program where I'm teaching middle school through 12th grade. And I'm going to be using your book as basically the structure of how to build what I want to build there. So I can't tell you how great this was for me to read this and how useful and practical I'll be able to use all the information. And then to be able to talk to you like this was just awesome.
Look, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for your questions. Great questions.
Yeah. And doing this podcast, we put in a little bit of time, but having you on and learning from someone like you, that's motivation for us to keep doing this. So it's just really cool that we got the opportunity. And then just wondering kind of what's next for you. You mentioned maybe a follow-up book.
Yeah. So I'm working on a book called Sparehead, where I'm looking at kind of the principles of elite military environments and how we can apply them to leadership situations. So going from Napoleonic times via the Navy SEALs and the SAS and other sports environments to look at it from a more kind of strategy into tactics area, strategy, tactics, and then leadership and mindset. So it's sort of a natural extension from the All Black story, but it's looking at it from a more military perspective this time around, but hopefully with application across sports, military, and business. So that's what I'm up to. It's a bigger subject than I could have ever imagined. I'm plowing through Clausewitz and all the great military theorists. So it's been fantastically interesting, but quite a daunting task.
Yeah, we're excited to see you break it down for us.
Yeah, hopefully we can have you on after that one, if we didn't scare you away.
Yeah, look, I'd love to. Okay. I'd love to.
All right. Thanks, James.
We'd really like to thank James Kerr for coming on the show and to all of you who followed along and read Legacy. If you like the show, please subscribe on iTunes and write a review. Join us next week as we talk with coach and club director Lauren Anderson.
I want to leave practice happy. I want to look forward to practice. I don't want to look forward to being a different person. You know, that's who I was becoming, a different person at practice. I wasn't me. I was doing this stuff that I was told I had to do, and it wasn't what I believed. But I didn't know a different way because there wasn't a model for me to look into. And so I really started reaching out to other coaches and searching for a different model.
That's next week on Coach Your Brains Out.